Welcome to the Common Sense Spirituality Show, the show that takes the mystery out of spirituality with your host, David Gagan, engineer, science director, scholarly researcher of life's mysteries, and author of The Endless Journey.
I'm Dave Gagan, host of the Common Sense Spirituality Show, and I'd like to welcome you to today's show, which I call Tantra. In today's show, we're going to talk about how we might live a more fulfilling life. Our guest today is Mark Allen, the internationally renowned author of numerous books, to include his latest book, Tantra for the West, A Direct Path to Living the Life of Your Dreams. Mark is the founder, president, and publisher of the New World Library, and along with his wife, Arlene, they founded the Brazil Hope Foundation to help the street kids in Brazil. I'd like to welcome Mark Allen to the show today. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you, David. Thanks for having me on.
I appreciate you coming. I read your book, Tantra for the West, and I really enjoyed it. And what I want to do is I want to talk a lot about that book here today. And I think the best way to start out is to just ask you, what is Tantra?
Yes, what is Tantra? I do remember an interviewer in Oregon got upset with the word Tantra and said, why do you have to use a word like Tantra? Why don't you use an American word like Chevrolet or fork? out of
right.
A million words in the English language, those were the two he chose, which was kind of interesting. But you know, I thought about it for a second and said, you know, if there was an equivalent English word, I, of course, would use it. Of course. I think the only two foreign words I use in the book are tantra or tantra and karma, because there isn't really an easy English equivalent for karma either. You can say law of cause and effect, or as you sow, so you shall reap or something, but there's nothing as really good and clear as karma. Once you understand the concept of karma, meaning our thoughts and actions have effects in the world and in our lives, you know? And It's the same with tantra or tantra.
Which way do you like to pronounce it? What do you think? Does it make a difference or?
It makes no difference to me. It makes no difference. A lot of, I think the American way may be tantra. If you study tantric Buddhism or tantra from India, they call it tantra.
Okay.
From the East, Hindu tantra. But a lot of people in the West say tantra, so either way, it seems fine with me, whatever you want to say it. But the whole concept is really very brilliant and easily applied to the West. And it took me several years of studying Tibetan Buddhism at a Tibetan center in Berkeley, California, which they call the tantric branch of Buddhism. They call it Tantra, the path of Tantra. And the Lama kept saying it's the direct path. The teacher kept saying it's the direct path. It's the path that gets you there quickly. It's the path that resolves difficulties. And it took me a while to realize what he was talking about. And it finally dawned on me, what he was talking about, the path of Tantra, is the path of every moment of our lives, rejecting nothing. It's the path that uses everything in our lives. So there isn't just a certain period when you meditate or certain practices or certain rituals. No, it's the path that incorporates every moment of our lives. One of the first exercises he had us do, for example, was go sit in this basement without any windows, sit around in a circle, and then he said, imagine that's your mother laying there in the middle of this circle and she has just passed away. How do you feel? Most of us were young 20-something and had parents that were still alive and vital. We'd never thought that through. But we spent the whole afternoon exploring grief, the emotion of grief. And I realized, oh, this path he's teaching incorporates every moment, every feeling, every event in our lives, waking or sleeping, even our dream states. Everything is fuel, grist for the mill, you could say, or fuels our path. And that's why it helps. It's great therapy is what it is. It's more
that is a hard concept for people to grasp, you know, that it involves everything in our life and brings that in. You know, it's just hard to, for a Westerner, that's a hard thing to grasp, you know?
It is. It took me a while to even figure out how to put it in those words. I could see him struggling to put into English what he knew so well in Tibetan. And translating it for him was not easy at all. And the book, Tantra for the West, then, is my attempt to really translate what he knew and what he was teaching into the English language. And it is, it's a difficult concept, but in a way, it's not. It just involves every moment of our lives rejecting nothing. So especially if we're upset about something, if we're frustrated about something, great. That then is what our meditative practice is in this moment, dealing with that frustration or anger or grief or whatever it is. He said he gave us a great teaching that I was able to apply in my life, saying that everything, and this is an ancient teaching which is totally scientific when I think about it, everything, every object, every emotion even, everything in our lives has three levels of being, he said. It has its outer level, like our body, for instance. There's an outer level where a certain height, weight, hair color, with the things obvious to other people, our outer level. Then we have an inner level. So our bodies, well, we have all these organs doing da da da. And you go deeply enough into the inner level, and you get into the secret level. And the secret level is where the answers are found, where awakening is experienced, where problems dissolve. So say our bodies, for instance, our outer level, our inner level, all these organs. Well, you go more deeply into the inner level, and this is where it gets scientific. More deeply, well, there's all these molecules and atoms. You go more deeply into it. What are these atoms? What are our bodies actually composed of? Well, there's all these subatomic particles that seem to be almost all empty space. And we get into something that they've been chanting in India for thousands of years, that form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. We are mostly empty space and connected with the whole quantum field. When we go deeply enough into the inner structure of anything, that's what we come up into, what, you know, physics and science has discovered in the last 100 years. We really are one with in this great quantum field. And understanding that secret can help us dissolve all of our imaginary problems in life.
Now you said something a minute ago, and I want to jump back to it. You said that I guess he was your guru. He was your teacher of this. And he said it's a direct path. Tantra or Tantra is a direct path to get you there quicker. What's there? Where is it getting you?
He talked about enlightenment and the top of the mountain of human consciousness. In one of the famous Tibetan paintings, they call tankas, the cloth paintings, but their painting of the universe has in the center this mountain that's actually a pyramid mountain, and it's the center of the universe, and it has all these different colors going up the mountain, all these bands of colors, and they're levels of human consciousness. The band at the bottom is red. And I remember him pointing to that one at the very bottom. There's a red band, and he said, that's where murderers are. That's the lowest human consciousness you can go, is to murder another human being. And then it goes up from there. Our levels of human consciousness rise and rise and rise up to the top, where it's total enlightenment, realizing what is complete. It's bliss. It's a complete enjoyment of every moment, total love. And that's what he meant by there. He meant complete, the awakened mind.
Okay. All right. But that makes good sense. Okay,
in a more practical sense, then what I took it to mean too is just a healthy mind, and I took it to mean good therapy. When I think about it, I was there in my 20s. I spent almost 4 years there because I was looking for good practical therapy. I had periods of depression and a lot of anxiety in my late teens and early 20s, and I did not want to experience a life filled with depression and anxiety. So that, to me, was there. What I wanted was some kind of effective therapy.
And okay, so you had a real purpose to go after this knowledge. How did you end up going there? I mean, you know, there's a big world. How'd you end up going there? I assume you grew up in the West somewhere. Right, here in the United States or something?
Right, I grew up in the Midwest, and I was actually a theater major at the University of Minnesota, and then joined a theater company in Minneapolis right out of college. This great company called the Firehouse Theater that did all these progressive plays. But I did have these periods of depression and all this ongoing anxiety. And now I look back and I'm grateful for those, because that really made me leave the theater and wander around. First, I followed my girlfriend into a Zen center. We ended up going first, the whole company ended up in San Francisco, and we ended up going to the San Francisco Zen Center, and I met the teacher there, Suzuki Roshi, who was this amazing man. I looked at this old man, and he had this light in his eyes and this lightness to his being. He was always on the verge of laughter. And I ended up then following my girlfriend to Hawaii, where there was the Maui Zendo. And there was an old man there named Katsuki Sekeda, 77 years old, a wonderful bee. And he had that same quality. And I said, I want that. I want what they have. I want a life filled with lightness and ease and joy. I don't want to struggle so much. So I spent 6 months at the Zen Center there in Hawaii. And then I got kicked out for breaking the rules. They had way too many rules. Since Zen was too structured for me. But then I did wander into a Tibetan center in Berkeley. And there again, that teacher had this life and light in his eyes. And he knew something that I didn't know. And I wanted to find out what it was. And I spent almost 4 years there before I feel I grasped something that I could use in my life, in the world, in America today.
Yeah, wisdom doesn't come easy, does it?
No, it doesn't.
Hey, let me move to something that you said in the book, and I want you to explain it for me if you could. You said we need to confront our negative feelings with a four-step process. I think our listeners would be interested to hear about your four-step process to go after our negative feelings.
Right. Let's see. The specific four steps, do you have right there?
I do indeed. It starts out and it says, ask what I am feeling right now.
Right. What I did there was simplify a process that has more steps and try to do this simplified version. And yes, that basically it's just really confronting that negative emotion. What do we mostly do with our so-called negative emotions? When they arise, we don't like it. We try to move past them. We try to not go into them, certainly. We try to resolve them and go on. And what I saw this teaching do, these Tibetans do, was to go into it. At one point, the teacher even said, well, there's three sort of different kind of paths for different kind of people. We all have our path up the mountain toward our awakening awareness, toward the resolution of all our problems, the peak of the mountain of human consciousness. And across our path, there's patches of poison growing, he said. Now, poison in Tibetan is the same as negative emotion, interestingly enough, or fear, anger, grief, envy, jealousy. They call poisons, and they say they literally poison the body. Maybe they're right about that. But they say there's patches of poison on our path. The monk or the nun comes up the path, sees the poison, and immediately goes the other way. And that's a perfect path for the monk or the nun, to just avoid the negative emotion and go the other way. Then the awakening being comes up the path, sees the poison, and plows right through the poison on up the mountain to his or her awakening. And that's a wonderful path. He called that the path of the bodhisattva. Then the tantric yogi comes up the path, sees the poison, and immediately goes off the path into the center of the poison. Into the center of the poison, even though it apparently takes him or her off the path. Okay, I thought about this for a long time. What does that story mean? It means when an emotion arises, the best thing we can do is plunge right into the center of it. If it involves anger, it doesn't mean we hurt other people. We have to do this without hurting other people. But we get into the center of whatever emotion is arising. So the first thing we do when we feel an emotion is not run from it at all. We dive into the middle of it and really say, what is going on? And really look at that emotion. And we explore that emotion. And we even can go from the outer to the inner, to the secret level of that emotion. Like we did with grief when the teacher had us imagine our mother had just died. We spent a whole afternoon first exploring the outer levels of grief. There were many tears and all these obvious feelings of grief. Then inner, you get into the inner level of grief. What is going on in your body? Real sadness, real loss, real feelings of aloneness and abandonment maybe, or whatever you're feeling. You feel those things. You go into them more and more and more deeply, and that's where the secret arises. And the secret is an individual thing. It's a feeling beyond words for people that completely varies from one person to another what that secret is. So you can't really put it into words for everybody. If you could, if every teacher could, then they all would, and no one would have any problems in life. But it doesn't work that way. You have to explore. You have to get into that grief. You get deeply enough, and you realize you have a breakthrough. You realize you feel that grief because of love. You wouldn't feel grief if you didn't love that person. And then you come to realize that love is still there in some way, that love survives death, and that love is part of you. And part of what is. And you get to a point where everything changes when you really explore every emotion deeply.
So there's really no right or wrong emotions. I mean, they are what they are. And the key here is facing them, dealing with them, and kind of going with the flow and just kind of understanding yourself and knowing what, you know, that's what they are. They're just emotions.
Right. That's true. Yes, there's no right or wrong. You go deeply into it enough, you see every emotion. They, in some ways, they're the same. They come and they go. They come and they go. They arise and they pass. There is a motion to our emotions. They arise and they pass. And yes, there's not a right or wrong or good or bad.
Yeah, and then you say afterwards, you say it. You know, you ought to share this emotion or share this discovery, as how you put it, with someone else, which finalizes it.
Right. It's a very good thing to do when you do have a breakthrough. A lot of this work is walking around, doing it yourself, being alone, doing it. If you're frustrated with something, the best thing you can go do is be alone and really get into that frustration until you get into the inner part of what is this frustration, what's going on, and then that breakthrough happens. You find some secrets, you find some wonderful truths, and then it really is wonderful to have some friend. And if you just have one, That's all you need, and that's a wonderful thing. Some friend you can share this with. Some sympathetic friend.
Yeah. Do you need a certain amount of self-love to be able to do this? You know, I kind of break love up into three different categories just to make it easy for me to understand. I look at it, self-love, which is fairly straightforward, at least a concept. The personal love, which is loving family and friends and people that you know well. And then the impersonal love, under, you know, loving, you know, the world, the other people, the guy that cut you off on the freeway this morning, you know, a broader view of it. But if we go back to the self-love part, is, do you need self-love to be able to do this process that you're talking about?
I think it certainly leads to a wonderful self-love. I think at some point you realize when you go into things that you treasure yourself as much as you treasure anyone else in your life. If you're lucky to have fallen in love with someone else, you really see what love for another person is. And at some point in our awakening, I think we all realize we're very special and very important. Yes, self-love is a wonderful thing. This lifetime, this human life, is a great opportunity, they keep stressing. It's a great, wonderful opportunity. As Houston Smith summed up his Eastern studies, he said, the human opportunity, the religions tell us, is to transform our flashes of insight into abiding light. Ah, yes, this life is a great opportunity. And yes, it's wonderful to love ourselves. Just loving ourselves and others is a wonderful path in itself, too. There's different paths for different people. You know, there's path for an emotional person. Just finding that real love of self and others is a wonderful thing to do.
Yeah. So you see this. You don't need the self-love. Maybe this leads to it. You know, if you're struggling with self-love and wondering who you are and why you are, this is a way to help lead you to that, you think?
I think it does lead to self-love, yes, when you get into it. For some people, having a child is such an awakening experience. And I do remember when I had my son and I gazed at him and held him, I felt a love like no other. And then I remember wandering around alone after that, sort of in a state of shock, and I realized I need to love myself as much as I love that child that I've had. And that love is just total and unconditional and complete. And I need to love myself as much as I love my child.
Yes. A lot of people don't recognize that. I think that's one of the big struggles in life. I think that, you know, I think it's easy to love your child. I think it's almost automatic. I'm not sure it's that easy for some people to love themselves. And that's a huge thing that if they could learn it, it would help them immensely, I think.
Immensely, because we are wonderful, miraculous beings. When we think about it, we are just, even our physical bodies are absolutely miraculous things. Trillions of cells working together in this amazing harmony. Science is just beginning to uncover how phenomenal our physical bodies are, and our emotional bodies and our mental capabilities are awesome. And we all have some kind of spiritual connection. We are spiritual beings having a physical experience. So it's all, we should love that. We're awesome creations of an amazing universe.
Yeah, I wholly agree with that. Hey, we talked a little bit about negative and how we need to face it. Let's talk a little bit about affirmatives, because I think that's what a lot of your book is about. It's the power of positive thinking, as Norman Peale said years ago. Talk to a little bit about, you know, your views on, you know, thinking positively.
Yeah. Well, I think a common thread in every tradition, East and West, that I've ever found is that words have great power. Words, the words we say, in the beginning was the Word, it says in John. The words we repeat to ourselves have great power. In Eastern traditions, it's mantra. You chant these mantras. In Western tradition, it can be prayer, repetitive prayer, or anything. Any words that we repeat have a tremendous power to change our lives. is we can only think one thing at a time. So if we keep putting in words of power, words of affirmations, they can really affect our lives powerfully and quickly. And I have used affirmations. I have found the right affirmations that have changed my life. I've done it in very concrete ways, in financially and all that. I've gone from a poverty case to a multimillionaire, and mostly by examining my feelings and getting into them. And when I did, I realized that I had all these negative feelings about money and wealth. And once I realized those feelings, I found out the beliefs underneath them, and then I found the right affirmation that completely changed it. That was the entire process. I realized when I was in my early 30s, I had the belief that I don't understand money, I'm a fool with money, I'm out of control, and that's why I was struggling so much, and I was on the verge of bankruptcy. And when I explored that frustration, and I got down to that, oh, I am telling myself, I believe I'm a fool with money. I just don't understand. That's my belief. And it sure seemed true in my life, because I was broke. Always. I never had money in the bank or anything. I was always struggling. When I realized that was my belief, the deep belief, I studied with a very interesting guy named Ken Keyes Jr. I took a weekend workshop from this guy. He's passed away now, but he had written a book called Handbook to Higher Consciousness. He understood one great thing. He understood about our beliefs and had a process called the core belief process, which is in all of my books, because it can change our beliefs. And he understood that our beliefs were not true in themselves, because there are a great many people with totally different beliefs. Opposite beliefs, even. But our beliefs become true in our experience if we believe them. So I believed I was a fool with money out of control, and so that became true in my experience. Once I believed that, once I realized that belief, then I looked at that and I said, I want to change that. I no longer want to believe I'm a fool with money. I want to believe, and I thought about it and wrote this down, I am sensible and in control of my finances. I am creating total financial success in an easy and relaxed manner, a healthy and positive way. That was the affirmation I came up with in my early 30s. And I repeated it a few thousand times maybe in a few months following when I came up with it. And in a few months, my whole life started turning around financially. And within a year, I was on a real solid basis and have been ever since.
Yeah, you say in the book that the body is a servant of the mind. I really like that.
Yeah.
And I believe it, but I think most people would see it the other way. What are your thoughts on that?
I did in my 20s. I found a wonderful book called As a Man Thinketh, that from an English writer named James Allen, written in 1904. That book really helped drive that concept home. I, in fact, edited the book a bit, and I call my version As You Think. I think it's a bit better. It's a bit more modern language, As You Think. But it starts with a poem. If you get the poem, you don't need to read the book. The poem is, mind is the master power that molds and makes, and we are mind, and evermore we take the tool of thought, and shaping what we will, bring forth 1,000 joys, 1,000 ills. We think in secret, and it comes to pass. Our world is but our looking glass. That sums it up. We are mind first. First and foremost, everything started as a thought. When you think about it, it's common sense. Everything has to start as a thought. A building has to be a thought in the mind of the architect, and then that thought becomes a blueprint on paper, and then all these activities happen in the world that end up building the building. But it begins all as a thought. That's how everything begins, as a thought.
Yeah, you go even further than that, because I wrote this down because I loved it, but I'm not sure I totally understood it, how you meant it. You said creation takes place with the following steps. The first step is a spiritual impulse. The second step is a thought. Third step is a feeling. And the fourth step is physical manifestation. Let's go back to that spiritual impulse. What is that?
If you look at so many traditions, East and West, and in between, like Kabbalah, but also tons of Eastern traditions and Western magic and a lot of traditions say we have four bodies. We don't have just one body. We're composed of four different bodies, a physical body, a mental, you could call it body, or a mental level of being is another way to put it. Levels of being maybe is better.
Okay.
An emotional level of being, and even a spiritual level of being. And things start on the highest spiritual level of being. Creation, all of creation, you could say, starts as a very subtle spiritual impulse. But it's very subtle. It's even beyond thought, beyond words, because those are from our mental level of being and our physical level of being. So things you could say, you could think, really are all spiritual. We are the spiritual life energy. What do I mean by spiritual? I've often thought about it. You could even just call it life energy. Our physical body is a dead corpse, except for this life energy that permeates every cell. That's our spiritual body. When that spiritual body leaves, we become a dead corpse again. So we have this spirit infusing everything. And I think all of creation really starts on these high spiritual, wonderful levels.
Then, so when you talk about creation, excuse me for interrupting.
Yeah, yeah.
When you talk about creation, I'm sure you're talking about the ultimate creation. In other words, where this universe came from. But are you also talking about creation of virtually anything that we do?
Right. It is the ultimate creation of the whole universe, and it is the creation of a bigger bank account or lunch or anything we create goes through the same process.
Okay.
Creating lunch, for instance, there's some high spiritual impulse. Then it all becomes a thought, and that's where we can say all creation begins with a thought. In the beginning is the thought. And that becomes then an intellectual idea, a mental idea in our mind. Before we create anything in reality, including lunch, whatever we're going to have for lunch, we first come up with a thought. What am I going to have for lunch? Should I have this or that? We even entertain different possibilities in our mind first. Then once we've got an idea, I'm going to have lunch, then it even becomes more powerful. It becomes a feeling. Yes, I'm going to go. I'm going to get up and go to the refrigerator and get my lunch. You know, it becomes a feeling. And then once you have that feeling aligned with that thought, it leads to action. That's what gets your body up. That thought drives you up from your chair and over to the refrigerator to get your lunch. And then it becomes a physical action. So it all started on some high level, and then it all really became a thought. So all creation is a thought.
Yeah.
So we can really affect our lives when we realize we can change our thoughts. We can affect our thoughts. When we do, it changes our entire world.
That's why negative thoughts are detrimental to what we're trying to do in life, and our positive thoughts are, aim us in the direction that we think we want to go.
Right, right.
Good. Okay. Now, what you said that we should form a partnership with everyone we meet. Now, there's a lot of people would say, and I've met so-and-so, and I really don't want a partnership with them. What do you mean by that?
Well, on one level, again, I love that you call your show Common Sense Spirituality, because it is common sense. It's undeniable that the human species on this planet is one species. We're one family. We're stuck with each other. So we need to learn to get along without killing each other. That seems to be common sense to me. The way we get along without killing each other is to work in partnership as much as we can with everybody in the world. And that partnership model, if you call it, is the key, really, to successful relationships on every level of our lives, including our relationship with ourselves and our intimate relationships, our work relationships, our community, our national relationships, the way our country affects the world. The key to success in every one of those areas is learning to work in partnership with people.
Now, you know, when I look at the world and I see people that are giving me a hard time, my adversaries, if you will. You know, if you think about it, you know, those are probably where I learn the most, because I have to deal with things that I don't want to deal with, whether they be emotions or thoughts or events or whatever it is, I don't want to deal with them. So this person who has irritated me has, in the long run, probably done me a huge favor. And of course, the people that you see every day and you like and enjoy, you know, they're doing you a huge favor, too, by being your friend and so on and so forth. But when I look at it that way, you know, you can see where a partnership, if we look at it from that perspective, a broader perspective, would make a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you really hit on a very important key to becoming real healthy in terms of your relationships with others and everything. Something I say in Tantra for the West is, within our darkest moments, our brightest treasures are found. At the time, I was thinking specifically of those difficult, deep emotions that we want to avoid. Within those, we can have some great breakthroughs. But as you're just saying now, it's true. It's even within the people we don't like, we can really make some great breakthroughs. Why don't we like these people? Well, maybe some of them are opposed to our way of life and challenging us. And, you know, maybe some terrorist wants to destroy. People always jump to these extreme cases, but they do exist in our world. So we have to look at them. You know, what about these terrorists that don't want you to continue living? They want to destroy you. Well, even those people we have to sit down with. I forgot who what it was that said a brilliant thing. They said, we have to learn to talk to people we disagree with. It was some politician who said, this is the key. We're going to disagree with people. That's natural. There's a lot of people in the world with a lot of very different attitudes and beliefs. That's right. What it is. And there are people that are going to disagree with us and people we are going to disagree with. Fine. But we need to keep talking to them. If we only talk, keep talking, we can come to some kind of way of living together without killing each other. And maybe the living together has to be in totally separate countries, in completely separate right. societies, you know.
At least for a while.
I'm not going to let anyone come around my world and tell me how to live my life. You know, we are the land of the free. We like that. We want to promote those ideas throughout the world. That's fine. But other people can live the way they want. That's their choice. And we just need to learn to talk to everyone. Negotiate is a wonderful word. Some people politically don't even, you know, say we should no longer negotiate. That's wrong. Negotiation is the key. We need to learn to respect everyone on the planet just because they're alive and they're a human being. We may completely disagree with their ideas, but we need to respect the fact that they're a human being and deserve life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness just like everyone else.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I want to talk about karma a little bit. You mentioned it earlier. Tell me your views. I think karma confuses a lot of people. Tell me what you think karma is and kind of how it works. What's your view?
Yes, it is. It can be confusing. I, I see it quite simply. I see it as something Christ taught, certainly, as you sow, so you shall reap. Mm-hmm. That's karma. That book, As You Think by James Allen, is a whole reflection on karma, on the results of our thoughts. Any thought held on to and repeated has results in the world. Any action we do first began with a thought. So we, our thoughts, where do they arise from? All of our past experience. We have all these thoughts. So many of us act without awareness even of our thoughts. And then we're on this endless wheel of karma, and the results, we keep creating more and more problems in our lives. When we really do become aware how karma works and that it's all thought and its results, we can start affecting our thoughts and we can change our karma. We can go beyond past karma. We have individual karma and we have cultural karma. The whole society has a karma. Every family has their karma. Every group, when you put it together, it's the result of all the previous actions leads to what it is today. And then that leads to the momentum to do the next things. Well, if those things are not beneficial, then we can change it. It leads me to a real positive way of looking at our possibilities as human beings, because we're not destined to lives of frustration and poverty and worse yet, violence and things that we're not in control of. We can control our destiny. We create our destiny through our own thoughts. And then in doing so, we change our karma.
Yeah. I look at karma as kind of a personal thing. Now, I can certainly see where if you have a group, you could have of people, there's a karma that everybody has, and I don't know how you average it, but there's I could see where, you know, you would have similar ideas and concepts. But you know, I look at karma in a very positive way, and in fact, I'm not sure there's anything such thing as negative karma, because when I look at it as the world, the universe, if you will, not the world, the universe is the probably the main function, or at least a main function, as far as I'm concerned, from the universe, is to teach me wisdom and to teach everybody else wisdom, and so when we do something wrong and when we make a mistake, then karma kind of puts a tag on us and it says, hey, he doesn't know something, and we got to teach him that. And some of these lessons can be difficult, especially, you know, if you've done something like, you know, rob somebody or murder somebody. You know, it's some pretty tough lessons. But those lessons are positive because they're teaching us how to act and how to behave. So even though we do stupid things and it looks like, you know, we got some negative things we got to deal with, they're really not negative in the long run. They're just difficult to go through in the short run. What do you think of that?
I absolutely agree, and I think that's very well put. Very well put. Our lives, as soon as we look at our lives as this endless educational opportunity, it changes everything. It changes everything. We no longer are the victims of any circumstances beyond our control. We're absolutely creating our own destinies. And yeah, when things happen, even if we fall and break a leg, okay, what's the message? Ah, the universe is telling us we have to slow down a bit. We right. gotta, you know, take a break, lay on our backs for a while. That's the message of breaking a leg.
Yeah, exactly. And it may seem bad, but in the long run, it's not bad. You know, the universe gives us what we need, and we just have to deal with it. But it's all in our best interest. There's nobody out there looking to sabotage us, make our life miserable. You know, I always say if I want to see the culprit who caused all my problems, all I have to do is find the nearest mirror, and there he is.
I absolutely agree. Yes.
We are coming to a close here. I had a whole bunch of interesting questions that I was going to ask you because, you know, I think you and I think very, very similarly. And unfortunately, I don't have time to go into a lot of those things. But I would like to ask you, you're doing a lot of interesting things in life. Is there anything that you would like the listeners to know about what you're doing? Maybe in particular Brazil, the Brazil Hope for Hope Foundation, things like that. Yes, tell us about that.
Oh yeah, my wife is Brazilian from Rio, and we often talk, and I know there's literally thousands of great nonprofits that are really doing wonderful work in the world. So I encourage people to pick one and support it, And what we've decided to do is support the street kids in Rio, who still have a tremendously tough situation. The people do not like these street kids. They call them all thieves. There's racism there because most of them are black skinned or dark skinned, and these poor kids are really still very badly treated by all of society. There is this wonderful woman named Avani DeMello who's like a Mother Teresa. She drives every day into the favelas, which are the slums, and she has a place, and she cleans up these kids. She gets them into clean clothes. She gets them showered. She feeds them every day. They're homeless street kids. Or some of them have parents that are on drugs and not able to function. Others are completely orphans, and she provides them with food, clothes, gets them cleaned up, and gets them books, and gets them into school. And she changes these kids' lives. She's done it with hundreds and hundreds of kids. So we totally support her. We raise all the money we can to help her. She's helped hundreds of kids. And we also help this other organization that when kids have cancer, they often don't have places to stay near the treatment and have to take buses for hours and hours and hours to come in for treatment. So there's this other organization that provides housing for the kids and a parent of theirs to stay while they have cancer treatment. So we support that too. Those are the two things we support.
And how can people find that? Is it on your website?
Yes.
Can you get there that way?
Yes, from markallen.com, markallen.com. Okay. There is a link there saying Brazil Hope, and it's a nonprofit 503c corporation, so they can write off any contributions, and 100% of every contribution they give goes to those kids in Brazil. Nobody along the way takes any of the money. It gets to feeding and clothing and buying books for kids in Brazil.
Yeah, that's really good to know. All too many, you have these high level executives taking more than you'd care to do.
Right. Your contribution to the nonprofit provides them with a job. That's
exactly
what you're contributing to,
and a darn good one at that. Mark, it has been an awful lot of fun having you here today. You know, I'll tell you one of the things that I love about this radio show is I talk to people who have come to the same conclusions that I have through totally different paths. And it's neat to see that there's not one way to get this information. You have to be a seeker, you have to go get it. But there's a lot of paths that take you to the answers in life. But you have to put a little effort into life to go get it and to go find that. And I loved having you on today. I hope to get you back because I got a whole bunch of other questions to ask you. So maybe we can get together again sometime. But thanks so much for being here.
Oh, thank you, David. My pleasure. Yeah, I loved what you said. It's true. We all have a different path, and it's just finding what works for us.
Indeed it is. Take care.
Take care.
Obtaining wisdom is a long process, as no one can bestow it on us. The more we talk and hear each other's ideas, the more we'll be able to mature our own views. You can contact me through my website at davidgagan.com. I hope to hear from you in regards to your thoughts about today's show and ideas for future topics. Also, I cover all these subjects and a lot more in my book, The Endless Journey. I look forward to sharing our thoughts every Friday morning at 9 a.m. here on W4CY.com. Truth is indeed stranger than fiction, and it turns out to be an amazingly good news story. We all have a great destiny ahead of us. Let me leave you with one last thought. You're a unique spirit having a life experience. You are far more important in the grander scheme of things than you can possibly realize. Enjoy your life. You've earned it.